Welcome back to The Rush, digging into addiction. From WSKG News, I'm Crystal Sarakis. Coming up, we talk to a scientist who explains what addiction does to your brain. But first, a look at addiction from a person who's been through it. Tracy Helton Mitchell is the author of the recent book, The Big Fix, Hope After Heroin. It's a story about rebuilding her life after a long bout with drug abuse. She says her first drug of choice was food.
In the 70s or in the 80s, there weren't a lot of fat kids, so I sort of opened myself up to a lot of teasing and bullying. That made me a very sort of angry, sort of, isolated person. I was very advanced in school, so then that was another set of things. And then when I wasn't really into even, experimenting with alcohol or marijuana. I had done a little bit of that as a teenager, but then when I was 17, I had my wisdom teeth pulled, and I just remember the feeling of not caring anymore, just for a brief few days while I was, healing. And I sort of bookmarked that feeling for later, and I had got involved in a relationship with this person who was really not a very good choice, and he was very abusive. And, when that relationship ended, I was just totally devastated, and I remember, wanting to escape my feelings. And so first it was alcohol, and then it was, my friends would get in their parents' medicine cabinets. They would have these leftover medications, or they would get, they would break their arm and be prescribed something. So we'd sort of experiment with different opioids. About a year after I had started sort of experimenting with drugs, I tried heroin for the first time, and it was, an explosion after that.
What made you want to use a second time after you tried it for the first time?
The intense euphoria, that it is like nothing I had experienced. I was a person who constantly thought all the time, was constantly in battle with myself, self-critical. And then for a moment, it was like all of that was relieved. And then very quickly, the solution then becomes the problem. I had experienced withdrawal. I didn't even know what it was. I had taken morphine for a few days, 4 days, and then my legs were twitching, and I was had this, fever. They call it the junkie flu. I didn't even know. I was very naive, and I didn't even really understand what was wrong with me. And I had begged my friend to suffocate me, and he said, "Oh no, you're just kicking." And I was like, "Well, what is that?" I didn't even know about the withdrawal symptoms and what would happen to me.
Do you think that you were addicted from that first or second use?
I don't know if I was addicted necessarily, but I would say that psychologically it was very powerful. It was a very powerful draw for me. I think if maybe things had been going differently in my life, where I'd had more support or positive reinforcement or positive things going on in my life, maybe things could have turned out differently, but that wasn't the trajectory that my life was headed in.
I wonder if you can talk about what your life was like during that period when you were using.
Initially when I started using, like most people, I had a job and I was going to school. I was going to the University of Cincinnati. And then, as my using sort of spiraled out of control, when I came out to San Francisco, I ended up being homeless. I was, just a complete mess. I was living in and out of hotels, occasionally prostituting myself, just taking advantage of whoever and whatever situation I could to try to get more drugs. I just remember there was one night in particular that will always stay with me, where, I was standing outside. I was in this alley where I was sleeping. A lot of times young people will sleep in little encampments together, and everyone was asleep except for me. And I was under the street light, and I was going through all my belongings, which lived in, I was in a shopping cart. I was standing there in the streetlight, and I thought to myself, someday I'm going to go back to school and I'm going to get my life back. And there's absolutely no reason why I should have believed that was true, because everything around me said I was going to be murdered, or I was going to die of an overdose, or, some kind of horrible infection. But for some reason, I kind of believed it. And then it was just another couple years of that where, whatever moment of clarity completely escaped me. Because when you get to a certain point of, I don't really believe in a bottom, but when you get into a certain point of, where things have spiraled out of control, I'm homeless, I have warrants, I have this drug problem, I'm completely separated from my family, I have no friends, I have all these medical problems. Like, where do you even start to the point where you feel like not even addressing it because it's magnified so horribly that it's just completely inconceivable that you could do anything to change your circumstances.
You mentioned that you don't really believe in a bottom, and of course that's one of the phrases that almost everybody uses when it comes to any kind of addiction. So why don't you believe in that concept?
Oh, because you can always go much lower. I mean, I've seen so many things in my addiction, like when people talk about, oh, you reach a bottom. It's like, no, actually, I've seen women prostitute with colostomy bags, you know, oxygen tanks, you know, a woman getting her arm amputated, you know, because the flesh was hanging out of her arm from an infection she didn't take care of for like 6 months. When people imagine a bottom, they picture their son or their daughter spending a few nights out on the street, possibly losing their job, you know, being turned away from their friends and then somehow coming home. It's like, no, it can actually get much, much worse.
Now, was there one moment that you can look back on and say, that's where everything changed and that's where I was firmly committed to recovery?
When I started shooting up in the soles of my feet is when I said to myself, you know, I absolutely have to do something different or I'm going to die. But at the time, I didn't know exactly what that was. It took a few months for me to get some insight. I just remember having a suitcase packed in my closet and the police had been looking for me because I wasn't, you know, following up with my felony probation. I remember saying, well, when they arrest me, I'm gonna go to treatment. I'm gonna beg them to go to treatment because there wasn't a lot of options back then to get into any sort of help on your own. You had to either privately pay or go to jail. Those were pretty much the two options. And so one wasn't available to me. So I had said to myself, I'm gonna go to treatment and I'm gonna do whatever they say and try to do this for real, just one time and see what happens. And that's exactly what I did.
Can you talk a little bit about what that process was for you?
Well, first you go through, as a person who uses opioids, you go through a 3 to 5 day period of intense physical sickness. You know, it's like the worst case of the flu you can imagine, where your legs are twitching, your eyes start watering, your nose is running. You have horrible digestive symptoms, throwing up, and then you can't sleep. And a lot of times you can't sleep for, you know, it can be up to a week where you're only sleeping a few hours at a time and waking up with these horrible leg cramps. And so then you go through what's called post-acute withdrawal symptom. And that can last, a few weeks, or that can last months, where it's almost like you feel like your best friend died because you have been artificially replacing your happy chemicals in your brain with heroin. And so your brain is now shut down production of its happy chemicals. You know, it's most a horrible feeling. Or you feel nothing at all, which is equally bad because, you know, we might be in a rehab program or people around you like, oh, aren't you so happy that you quit using drugs? It's like, no, I kind of am not right now because I'm not in touch with myself. And then slowly over time, you start to feel things again. And the first things you might start to feel is sort of like a remorse or this horrible feeling inside of your gut, like, how could I have possibly did this to myself all this time? And you feel the sort of the guilt and the shame. And, you know, I tell clients a lot of times, those in the early stages are really kind of useless emotions. Those are the things that cause people to relapse, is focusing on all the negative things that you've done. It's like you really have to start where you're at and start to build positive things into your life. And then when you have the emotional strength, go back and try to deal with some of the damage of the things that you've done. And so you truck along, you start to feel better maybe 30 days later, sometimes a couple weeks for some people. You might start laughing again, or you notice the bird chirping or the sun, you know, the sunset. And then you start to think about, what am I going to do with my life? And that's another set of, emotionally distressing things when, you know, you haven't worked for an extended period of time, or, you know, perhaps you've destroyed every personal relationship that you've had. So then you start reconnecting with your community, with, you know, your family, and it's a slow uphill battle. And then, you know, one day, you know, it varies from person to person. You start to notice that things are actually really, truly getting better for you. And you just have to hang on until you get to that point.
The decision to get help is so very individual. How do we, as family, as friends, and as members of our community, offer help for something that is such an individual choice?
I think the first step is really non-judgmental listening. I think that especially when people say heroin, it gives you sort of a reactionary feeling. So, you're killing yourself. It's like, well, they know that, but we have to kind of start where we're at with this process and listen to what different people need. I mean, the first step is literally making sure that people don't kill themselves so they have access to naloxone. They are not, you know, getting soft tissue infections from dirty needles or hepatitis C or different things. And then there's the process of getting people into whatever rehabilitation services they're willing to participate in. Forcing things on people isn't necessarily, from a public health perspective, the best interventions. We want to try to guide people to where we are at as opposed to pushing something onto someone.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Jake. He was a friend of yours when you were on the street. He was in the documentary Black Tar Heroin with you, and you saw him, that you write in your book, you saw him later at a point when you were both in recovery, and he was on methadone at the time, and it seemed to be working for him, but he wanted to get off of it because other people said he really wasn't clean as long as he was still on methadone.
Jake was a person who had multiple health issues, mental health issues. He was, you know, a very close friend of mine in our addiction. And so I was completely shocked when I ran into him and he told me, you know, I've completed a residential treatment program. I'm going to college. And he said that he was tapering off methadone because people in the 12-step meetings had told him that he wasn't clean. And it instantly tore at me because I thought, this is the best you've done in your entire life. You're, you know, you've had stable housing, a girlfriend, and why are you letting other people convince you that you're not clean? Because obviously, in the definition of what clean means to you or to anyone, really, it should be fine. There's nothing wrong with you. And so what had happened was he, you know, listened to other people. He got off methadone very, you know, quickly, and then he relapsed and he died. And I'd ran into him right after he had relapsed, and I had tried to convince him to go get back on the methadone treatment program. And it was very, very sad because I realized that opinions are not facts. So if my opinion is abstinence-based recovery is the only option, that is not actually a fact. Anyone in any phase of recovery can help. You can help another person. You can give a person a sandwich, a glass of water. Listening to a person non-judgmentally or assisting them with certain areas of their life is fine. But when we start getting to hiring counselors that have absolutely no training, their only training is based on their personal experience, your personal experience in your life can be very, very limited. So I don't discourage people from helping other people. It's when you start getting into professional advice, staying away from that is really critical.
In your work, do you also work with the families of users?
So I work with families on a voluntary basis. They contact me through my social media. They email me. A lot of times I get referrals from other people saying, would you be willing to talk to that person? I just try to link them either to information or sometimes they just need to get stuff off their chest because I think that for families in particular of where their child or their niece, nephew, whoever it is using drugs, they're very, very isolated. And I know for in particular with my own mother, you know, she couldn't tell anyone that she had a daughter that was a heroin addict. It would have made her completely socially ostracized at the time. So she kept all that inside of her. You know, it must have been very, very painful for my mother when I look back, not having any kind of touchstones, letters, anything from me except for when I was in jail. So the family members face unique challenges that I'm not necessarily the expert on, but I just try to, you know, provide an ear for them and then direct them to other family groups that might be able to help them or just give them some basic information.
Do you find yourself saying a particular thing to them over and over?
Well, the first thing I say to them is breathe, because I think when you find out that someone that you love is using heroin, it's very, very frightening. Because the first thing they imagine is that person is going to die somewhere with, you know, a needle hanging out of their arm or in a bathroom, and they're not going to know. I mean, I have children myself, and I can only imagine that many of the parents feel that they somehow did something to make this happen. in the very end, it's the individual's choice, and they're not forcing them to use drugs. So I just try to, you know, be empathetic and dive into it and see where you're at with what's going on.
You've been clean for 18 years now. Is it easier today?
It is so much easier than it was. I would say that the challenges I face today are very, very different than the first 5 years. I would say there, you know, and there's research that shows this. Once you kind of get through the first 5 years, your chances of relapse are much smaller because in the initial phases, you're just trying to get your life together. The first few years, you kind of have this fear that anything is going to happen and I'm going to slip and the needle is going to fall in my arm or I'm going to end up using again. And that's not really what happened for me. Like, even if I wanted to use drugs now, there's so many barriers to that happening. You know, there's so many things in the way. Like, first of all, I have a conscience. And second of all, you know, I have these great things in my life. I've removed all of sort of the conduits to me going back down that road.
Why did you write the book?
So I wrote the book because I felt like there's not a lot of books on long-term recovery. You read these books. I've read them myself. It's like using, great. And it's like the last chapter, and then I quit. Yay. And then it's over. And then they don't really explain like how they did it. And actually, a lot of those books, then you find out later that that person went back to using drugs or whatever. So I have a lot of years behind me, and I have a lot of experiences. You know, I had a miscarriage, and they tried to prescribe me all these opioids, and I already had wanted to, you know, kill myself or whatever because I was so depressed. And then they're trying to give me all these opioids. So there's like practical things that you deal with on a daily basis in long-term recovery that I thought hadn't really been covered. And then also really speaking to what it's like to be a woman who's had sort of a shady past and in sex work and then got into a healthy relationship. I think that's a lot that's, you know, missing is the hope. I think we have a huge deficit of hope in this country. I mean, it's hard to actually gauge how many active heroin users there are because so many people are using in secret, but the vast majority of people who use heroin quit. And I think that we don't emphasize that enough and we don't tell people, you know, you really can't quit. Like when I send these emails to people, you really can quit. Like, absolutely, you can quit. And no one says that to them. If I could do it, anyone can do it.
You've talked a lot about what we need to do to fix this. Are there things that we're getting right?
People are really waking up to harm reduction. And people are really trying to, the families in particular, are organizing and creating communities. If the opposite of addiction is connection, really connecting people back into the community and connecting the families is so important. I mean, I would say it's going to sound really strange, but like the first person that I really communicated with was actually my cat to a certain extent, you know, learning from animals and actually creating a connection with someone else made it so much easier for a person who'd been so isolated then to connect to other people. And then slowly I started letting other people into my life. I think, you know, building a connection wherever you can find it, connecting with nature, connecting with a social group, going back to school. And then also the movement to really give, you know, people who've been convicted of drug-related crimes back their civil rights. I mean, I was convicted of a felony for a $20 bag of drugs. And I currently, in California, I have the right to vote. But there's many states in the United States where I'd be completely disenfranchised from my civil rights. So, you know, it's really powerful that communities are saying, like in Massachusetts, where they're saying, we want to have treatment before jail. And I think that that movement is really going to make a huge difference here in the United States.
Well, Tracy Helton Mitchell, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
That was Tracy Helton Mitchell, author of the book, The Big Fix, Hope After Heroin. This is The Rush.